Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We may not have an overall recession. We're having a rolling recession.
The economy overall looks pretty strong, at least when it comes to jobs.
The financial stories that shape our world.
Three major regional bank failures
sent shockwaves through the banking system.
We're all trying to figure out what to make of generative AI.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Welcome now, Dr. Paul Krugman.
Brian Moynihan of Bank of America.
Deborah Lehr of the Paulson Institute.
Glenn Hubbard of the Columbia Business School.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Show me the money to keep the government going, to justify rate cuts, and for former President Trump to post his bond. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, Nadim Meji of Blackstone on the case for investing in real estate despite all you've heard.
What we see is a generational investing opportunity while others are looking in the rearview mirror.
And Lindsay Rosner of Goldman Sachs on the risks and opportunities in fixed income when yields are high but spreads are tight.
Where we're finding an interesting pocket is actually in structured product.
But we start with the U.S. economy. Calling it Goldilocks doesn't go far enough for Nobel laureate Paul Krugman.
I've been arguing with people who say, you know, this is a Goldilocks economy, and that's wrong. Goldilocks found a porridge that was neither too hot nor too cold. We've got an economy that's hot where you want it to be hot, like in GDP growth, and cold where you want it to be cold on inflation.
Even as sentiment numbers lag well behind.
The levels of sentiment are more like deep recession levels than sort of mildly pessimistic levels. I think a lot of that is unrelated to the economy.
And a lot of that negative sentiment is because of inflation, with some saying that the way the Fed calculates it makes it seem worse than it really is.
The Fed's inflation numbers are artificially high. I think if you look at real housing costs and you talk to the people who own collectively hundreds of thousands of residential units across the country, even in the best markets, rents are basically flat. Most people aren't moving from their home because their mortgage is low, so their occupancy costs are flat. So to say inflation, because of some metric that the Fed is using, is 6%, and that's 30% of inflation, I think you're overstating inflation by as much as 1.8%. So I think inflation is actually pretty benign right now. The economy is doing pretty well. So why should the Fed suddenly lower rates?
This week, we got the most recent numbers on inflation, the ones the Fed pays attention to, and core PCE came in just about where expected, showing inflation growing 2.4% year over year. After the most recent numbers, we sat down with San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly and asked her how she squares the strong growth and jobs numbers with the relatively weak consumer sentiment figures.
When you think about how hard it is to work as hard as you can, work multiple jobs, and not be able to afford things 1 month to the next, that has a psychological toll that I think we can't underestimate. And as the economy continues to make gains and we bring inflation down, that scar, if you will start to heal. But people need that certainty, and that's why we keep saying we're not done until we're done. You know, these good inflation data that we're seeing, that's not price stability. Two is.
For people in financial media and on Wall Street, the number one issue is rate cuts.
Yes, that is their number one issue. But we work for the American people, not for markets. So.
But explain it to me. In your summary of economic projections, the last one, you have 3 in for the year. That's a projection. It's not a promise. And some people think you should have more. Maybe some people think you have less. Why are we talking about rate cuts at all, given the strength of the economy? I mean, the economy seems to be doing just fine with the rate cuts you put in place.
So we put a projection out about what we think we'll need to do if the economy evolves as we expect it to. So what's the expectation? Inflation continues to come down gradually. The labor market and the economy slow but don't tip over. And then it would be appropriate, as inflation comes down, to bring the nominal rate of interest down to make sure we're not holding on even tighter, because we want to avoid the following. We want to avoid holding on all the way to 2%, putting policy very tight, and then cause an unnecessary downturn that you give people lower inflation, but you cost them their jobs. So that's a balancing act that means we have to be calibrating. So I want to just be clear, though. You don't see many Fed officials, including myself, talking about rate cuts. You see us talking about restoring price stability, bringing inflation down, being data dependent, looking at the full balance, being patient and methodical. So I do think that message is clear. It's not always what people necessarily want to hear, but it is a clear message that we've been on.
I'm not expecting you to tell us when you're going to cut rates, but let me ask a different question. I'm old enough to remember when Potter Stewart in the Supreme Court said about obscenity, you'll know it when you see it. How will you know it when you see it? This is the time we should start cutting rates.
That's a great question. So what I look at is what I think of as a dashboard of indicators. And the dashboard of indicators has the published data, which everybody focuses on. But those tend to be data points. And you don't want to be data point dependent. You want to be data dependent. So you have to look underneath the hood of those data and really see what's driving them. And also, you have to talk to people. And what I'm looking for right now is for the published data to continue to gradually slow and inflation to gradually come down, but for when the behavior, when I talk to firms, when I talk to businesses, et cetera, that they're saying, oh yes, we're not going to continue to raise prices. Oh yes, we see input costs coming down. Workers saying, we see jobs, we want to stick with our employer. We are not worried about 5% wage growth because we don't feel inflation's going to continue. I'm looking for those things to all come together and form a collage of evidence, if you will, that we are on the path to price stability sustainably. I'm seeing parts of that. I see a lot of green shoots, as we like to say, but we're not there yet.
You talked about your dashboard. Let me ask about one specific figure on your dashboard, and that is inflation numbers. There's some concern now that maybe inflation is overstated. I've talked to a couple of people who are pretty active in real estate, commercial real estate, in recent days who said the owner equivalent rent is overstating inflation as a practical matter. Somebody said actually recently on this program as much as 1.7 to 1.8%. Are you concerned that maybe we're overstating inflation right now?
So that's a really terrific question, and it might help for me to just talk about how I look at the data. So there are multiple inflation indicators, and you can unpack all of them into what's driving them. But we can't just look at those published inflation data to see the story. We have to actually go into communities and look at what's happening with local house price appreciation, what's happening with rental price appreciation. And there you do see the elements of the slowing you would expect to see. So I actually am growing more confident that housing inflation, shelter inflation, rental inflation are coming down. The speed at which they come down is still unknown, but I'm not seeing signs that they're picking back up yet.
What is the reason why you have such a concentration of tech in your district? I mean, we tend to think of Silicon Valley as being close to Stanford and Berkeley and some universities. Is it the educational system there? Is it some other factors? Is it just critical mass?
I think there is a bit of critical mass, and there's a number of research studies that say, you know, these network effects are large. So one of the things we've seen is, and you see this anywhere in the country really, is that people might start in Silicon Valley, they might start in Austin, Texas, they might start in Boston, but then they move. You know, family things take them other places. We have a lot of lovely states to live in, so people go other places, and then they build those tech centers around them because they have the expertise.
As strong as the tech sector is in Mary Daly's region, commercial real estate has been struggling a bit, as it has in some other major urban areas.
I was just in New York recently, and it seemed a lot more animated than certainly parts of downtown San Francisco. But again, I think the venture money is here, and we have a highly educated population. So as a labor market, literally no one can compete with the Bay Area. And that force for what the future is with some of this new technology is what's going to animate these large agglomerations, San Francisco, Boston, New York, and Los Angeles, Houston, and Miami, because of what's going on in financial services and the relocations in Miami. So I'm not a doom loop person at all for these cities. I think they are going to recover. There is going to be pain. As I just said, there are defaults, there are losses, there is retail closure. And I think the mix of real estate, especially in downtown San Francisco, where we have very little housing, so it's very dependent on the workforce for animation. And without that workforce, without a return to work, San Francisco is going to be challenged, whereas New York has a good mix of housing and office space within the urban core, Boston to the same degree. And San Francisco is going to have to figure this out with housing and to reanimate parts of its downtown.
Commercial real estate's a big name for a lot of different segments. So if you're in industrial and warehousing space, you're feeling very good about things right now. If you're in retail space or even multifamily housing out in suburban areas, then you're feeling really good. You're confident. The place where you're seeing weakness, and everybody knows it, is in the urban cores of particularly cities like Seattle, Portland, San Francisco. LA is doing a little bit better, but you can find pockets of this in LA. And that has to do with the fact that a lot of people are still working from home in those communities. Those big office complexes that were built up for those individuals to work in, they just aren't. They're not filled, and so there will be a repricing and a resettlement. The thing is, we've known it's coming for a while, and I see private equity money, venture money, sitting on the sidelines, ready to come in when the price is right. So there'll be some repricing, there'll be some loss of valuations for sure, but it doesn't seem today to be the kind of disorderly adjustment that you would worry about. It's something that is more orderly, even though it might be, it's certainly going to be painful for those involved. It's not as going to, it's likely to be as disruptive.
One of the concerns is about regional banks, which tend to be more exposed to really commercial real estate. And then we've heard about that from the Fed in Washington, some
Absolutely.
Concern about that. How do you assess it out there? You have a little experience with this, with Silicon Valley Bank and things like that. Well, how do you assess the risk for the banks, the regional banks?
Yeah, so I would separate the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and First Republic, which really, they all three had the same experience, which is depositors who were uninsured ran. And that's a different situation than the commercial real estate. But what they did, what that situation did, is it alerted all investors and depositors to the fact that there's a portfolio underlying the health of a bank, and we should focus on that portfolio. I think it's useful to remind people, too, we have over 4,500 banks in the United States, and only three failed. So the banking system is safe and sound and resilient, but there will be adjustments. And one of the things that you've heard the vice chair of supervision, Michael Barr, speak about, and other the FDIC chair and OCC, is really focusing their efforts on ensuring that banks are preparing for those adjustments. So it's certainly there. The final thing, though, that I think is really often not known is that regional banks don't have a lot in these big urban core office buildings. Those are really investor-owned, and so it's useful to separate the concerns you might have about regional banks on commercial real estate from those big, you know, monolithic empty buildings that everybody's worried won't get filled.
Many thanks to Mary Daly, president of the San Francisco Fed. Coming up, we go over the week in the markets with Barbara Reinhart of Voya.
That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA, SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. Most equity markets continued their upward climb this week, with the S&P 500 closing at another record high of 5137, up just under 1% for the week, and still nicely over the median year-end number of 5,000 from our Bloomberg Elves, despite the Elves continuing to raise their estimates every week. The NASDAQ had an even stronger week, adding 1.74%, while the yield on the 10-year was down just under 7 basis points to end the week at 4.18. To take us through the week in the markets, we welcome back now Barbara Reinhart, Voya Investment Management, CIO of Multi-Asset Strategies and Solutions. Great to have you back with us, Barbara. So what's causing this from your point of view on the markets? Is it that strong economy Mary Daly just talked about?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, David. Number one is you have to remember the Fed pivot rally that's been in place for the past 2 months has been pretty powerful, and it's been driven by a lot of multiple expansion, specifically since the end of October. Multiples have driven about 87% of the S&P 500's run. But you've had a relatively good earnings season as well, right? So earnings estimates continue to kind of bottom out and hook back up. The U.S. seems to be leading the way in this charge. And it seems as though the market's digesting that the Federal Reserve may not cut or may not cut as much as they expect this year, and they're taking it pretty much in stride.
Well, that's one of the things I'm interested in, because where the market was on how many cuts and where it is today is quite different. They've cut it like in half the number of cuts, and yet the markets didn't seem to take that too adversely. Why is that?
Well, the bond market certainly did, right? Yes. So you had the bond, long-dated treasuries had backed up pretty significantly, but the equity market was pretty much able to power through it. And we think one of the reasons that this is the case is that many companies, U.S. companies specifically, large cap companies, have termed out their debt. Mm-hmm. So they don't have big refinancing risks coming up in 23, 24, or 25. They're looking to later dates, more like 2027 and 2028, before they have to worry about refinancing. And we think that's a big reason that the equity market can look through some of the noise of pricing and Fed cuts.
One of the concerns you hear a lot about is concentration in the equity markets, and particularly this Magnificent Seven, or however we count it. How concerned should we be about that concentration, that it's not broad enough in the equity markets?
Well, concentration is indeed going global. You see it in the U.S. markets, you see it in the international markets as well, specifically in Europe and also in Japan. In the U.S., though, I think there's a really interesting point to look at this. So if you go back to the dot-com period in the early 2000s, right, the top five companies, they had a net income margin of about 20%, right? If you take a look at the top five companies in the S&P 500 this year, their margin is closer to 30 to 31%. I think you cannot strip out the operational dominance of these large companies and the high free cash flow that they are indeed throwing off every year. And I think when you take a look at it on a PE basis, no question, the market's expensive. But when you drill down on some of those other metrics, some of the froth starts to come out of it. And it's being supported by relatively strong earnings and relatively good free cash flow as well.
One of the things you hear about is valuation. I mean, does it make sense to buy more at these valuations? Because it seems to be a lot, what do they say, price to perfection?
Price to perfection is short. There's not many places that you can find great value at this point, along with improving fundamentals. But we do think that the U.S. is going to have another relatively strong year relative to the rest of the world. I know there's a lot of chatter going on in the markets right now about maybe buying Europe, maybe buying the emerging markets. China may do a big fiscal stimulus. We think that the relative valuation and the premium that the U.S. commands is for a relatively good reason. We're sticking closer to home. We're sticking in U.S. large cap stocks. If the Fed were to aggressively start cutting interest rates, it may make sense to go down in cap size. But right now, I think you're better off being in the U.S. And because the rest of the world isn't feeling particularly well, it's kind of a somewhat reminiscence of the mid-1990s. U.S. was doing well. Rest of the world was on its back. Relative strength for the U.S. dollar is another one to consider as well when you're going global.
On its back, but Japan is not quite the way it was on its back as before. Is that sort of coming up a little bit? I hear some talk about Japan.
It only took 34 years for it to recapture its 1989 high, right? So, look, Japan is a really interesting market to us. I think that if you're going to go out to Japan, you have to hedge your currency back into U.S. dollars. Japan, because they've been through so much over the past really three decades, the market doesn't tend to respond much to recessions as you do, say, in the U.S. or in Europe. But Germany right now is in a middling recession. Emerging markets don't feel particularly good. If I had to be any place, I'd probably stick in U.S. large caps.
U.S. large cap, not medium and small.
No, U.S. large.
Yeah, it's too hard to pick those stocks from the small to the large as a pragmatic.
You need a Fed rate cutting cycle to really get that smaller cap size of the market going.
One last quick one. What about terming out debt and fixed income? Because you might want to lock in some of these rates.
Look, we think that there's a lot of money sitting in money market funds at this point. Everyone says, I can get 5% in money market funds. Why do I want to do anything else? Even if the Federal Reserve doesn't cut interest rates this year, 5% won't be there forever. There's a reason that cash is generally not part of an asset allocation portfolio. I would say that the most interesting piece right now to us looks like longer dated treasuries. We think that they're good insulation against an economic slowdown, and you're getting that positive real yield.
Barbara, it's always a treat to have you.
Thank you so much.
That's Barbara Reinhart of Voya. Commercial real estate has taken something of a beating recently as higher interest rates and lower occupancy rates, at least when it comes to offices, have forced a repricing and a fair amount of refinancing as well. Blackstone is one of the leading investors in the asset class. And welcome now its global co-head for real estate. He is Nadeem Meji. Many thanks to Nadeem for being here. So Nadeem, give us a sense of where we are in commercial real estate. Have we seen the bottom?
Thank you, David, for having me on the program. You know, if you take a step back, we've had two really difficult years for commercial real estate, and there are really two reasons for that. One of those is a historic increase in rates, which put downward pressure on valuation multiples for real estate. The other thing that's happened is office buildings have faced a lot of pressure, and the combination of that has resulted in negative headlines and negative sentiment, and frankly, those headlines will continue to be negative because you're still going to have stories of banks dealing with loans that they made in a different environment at a different moment when rates were lower. Sponsors, owners who maybe did deals in a different rate environment. But from our perspective, that's all priced into asset values today. And in fact, when we look forward, we see something very different. What we see is a generational investing opportunity, buying opportunity, while others are looking in the rearview mirror. And what we believe is happening is that values are bottoming. And the reason for that is, number one, interest rates. Inflation is cooling. Rates have come down from their October highs from last year. And credit formation is once again happening in real estate. All-in borrowing costs are down 200 basis points over the last 5 or 6 months. and transaction activity is picking back up. The other thing that's happening that I think is underreported is this idea of new construction, which is down 30 to 70% in our core sectors versus 2 years ago. And I think that in the medium term will lead to a sharper recovery than the market likely expects. And then the third thing I would say, which is critically important, and we've been saying this for years, is where you invest matters. There's a huge bifurcation across asset classes. We all know what's happening with office. Values are under pressure. Rents are under pressure. In fact, U.S. office represents only 1.5% of our global portfolio because we were nervous about office. On the flip side, look at data centers, which are our fastest growing asset class. 2% vacancy, 25% rent growth, 10 times the demand that we saw only 5 years ago, and the AI revolution is just getting started. So for us, it's all about understanding the difference between the winners and the losers and doubling down in the places where we see more growth.
We hear a fair amount about warehouses with e-commerce, and especially now data centers with generative AI and the expectation we're going to need a lot more data centers. Are people already rushing into those properties that make it less attractive to you?
No, it's interesting. It's actually quite the opposite, which is to say that in both data centers and warehouses, for example, the fundamentals from a long-term perspective are as attractive as they've ever been. Yet there's a shortage of capital pursuing these opportunities. There's a shortage of liquidity in the system. So even as debt capital is coming back, there's still quite a bit less competition today than a couple years ago. So when I think about data centers, for example, this is an asset class where we took a view a few years ago that the combination of digitization of the economy, the cloud, artificial intelligence would all result in a greater demand for data centers because all of this data that's being created needs to be housed inside servers, inside data centers. And what we see on the ground is that the major technology companies have announced that they're going to invest $1 trillion of capital into their digital infrastructure over the next 5 years. That's going to drive more demand for data centers. And yet, very few people can capitalize on this opportunity at a moment like this because you need scale capital. Data center developments used to be $100 million. Now they can be as big as $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion. Very few people have that kind of capital. The other thing you need to have is a large land bank. You need to have access to power, which takes years to procure. You need to have relationships with the major technology companies. And so what we've done is we own a platform that we bought 3 years ago, QTS Data Centers. It's the fastest growing data center company in the world. We've taken that development pipeline from $1 billion only 4 years ago, 3 years ago, to today, $18 billion. We've grown the installed capacity by sixfold over this very short period of time. And we still think we're in the early innings, but again, not anyone can do this.
You mentioned Europe earlier. What opportunities do you see for you, Blackstone, in real estate in Europe?
Sure. You know, I think sometimes people are surprised by the fact that our most active region globally has been Europe in light of a sort of nominal backdrop, GDP growth that's been quite flat. But what it turns out is that sentiment is so negative today. Mm-hmm. And liquidity is so short that you have folks who need to raise cash. And so we've been buying from groups who, for whatever reason, are willing to part ways with high quality assets in this moment. But we're buying at prices today that don't require us to believe a V-shaped recovery. And so just as one example, we're acquiring warehouses throughout Europe. We've acquired 4 billion euros of warehouses in only the last 12 months. And what we see is deep value. And as we look forward, we think that that buying opportunity in Europe continues because there are very few folks who have the scale that we do who can compete with us across the continent.
Nadeem, it's a real treat to have you on Wall Street Week. Thank you for being here. That is Nadeem Meji of Blackstone. Coming up, we move from investing in real estate to investing in fixed income with Goldman Sachs Asset Management's head of multi-sector investing, Lindsay Rosner.
Typically, when there are geopolitical flares, you see a flight to quality rally. People go into treasuries. That has not been the case.
That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. After years of little or no return, fixed income is back as an attractive asset class. To take us through the opportunities and the risks, we welcome Lindsay Rosner, Goldman Sachs Asset Management Head of Multi-Sector Investing. So Lindsay, welcome. It's really great to have you on Wall Street Week.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
So let's talk about those opportunities and risks, because they are out there. Where is there risk you can take that you get paid for right now in fixed income?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting environment right now. Yields are abundant. They abound. However, spreads are tight. So you really need to be thoughtful about where you are taking that risk. And to your question, where are there opportunities? Writ large, U.S. investment grade, very, very tight spreads. High yield, pretty tight, tighter than average as well. Where we're finding an interesting pocket is actually in structured product. And what I mean by that is commercial mortgage-backed securities, CLOs, even some asset-backed securities.
So why isn't the market pricing that accurately now? What's the market got wrong about that?
Well, I think it's not necessarily that the market got it wrong, but what's happening in the market has changed so dramatically. And where we lived in 2023 and even started in January was a world in which the Fed may continue to hike, or at least hike and hold. At those high interest rate levels, it is very difficult for some of the collateral and some of these different structures in structured product to give value. And one of the big things, like commercial mortgage-backed securities, underlying it is commercial real estate. If there is a wall of maturity, how does that get refinanced, and at what rates? And again, the market was pricing in what those rates would be a lot higher, which decreased the value. Now, we had a really consequential CPI print in October, which told us, hey, a soft landing is very much on the table. And the deflation or disinflation is really taking hold. That has really changed that narrative that you see in the rates market. And for us, we believe that also changes the expected return or the outcome for various parts of structured products.
So pick up on that. I'm curious. There has been a real shift in the expectations about rate cuts this year. And some people think that's a bad thing because we won't have as many rate cuts. But I wonder if the reason the markets were pricing in that many rate cuts was actually the anticipation of a chance of a recession. And as that goes away, it actually reduces the need to cut rates.
So there is definitely less of a view of recession. Goldman had a fantastic call last year calling for a softish landing. I think it was lonely in that camp. Many were calling for a recession, and in fact, we really are getting a soft landing-ish situation. As that recession has really come off the table, the Fed doesn't have to do those insurance cuts to protect the economy. Instead, they can be more metered and take some time to be sure that inflation is coming down and that growth actually is not reaccelerating too much. So there's kind of this like happy medium kind of channel they're looking for.
Right now, as we sit here, it looks like things are pretty good in the United States. The economy seems to be doing pretty well. The labor market's in pretty good shape. You know, the rates have gone up, but they don't seem to be going up too far. What is the risk we should be looking out for that we may not be missing? I think early on in your career, you had some experience with that at Lehman.
Yes, I did have some experience with risks at Lehman Brothers. I was 2 years out of college, as I like to say. I am not responsible. I feel like I have to put that out there. But I learned a lot. And what I learned, and it's never left me, is that you don't necessarily know what the risk will be, but risk will come. And I think this is the idea of the black swan as well. Yeah. And they happen with frequency. So it's important, especially when things feel really good, to say what could be the problems. A few things that come to mind. Number one, geopolitical. You can literally spin the globe, put a finger down, and you're likely to point out a geopolitical tension, flare, issue, or maybe even something more pronounced right now. Of the geopolitical issues that are out there, especially ones that started even in 2023 or earlier than that, they are unresolved. It's not like we've crossed a geopolitical tension or issue off the list and say, that one we can put aside, it's done. It still exists. So that's something that's really important to remember that can be out there. Now, what's been interesting in the market is typically when there are geopolitical flares, you see a flight to quality rally. People go into treasuries. That has not been the case. So there is this real exuberance and euphoria, and it's exactly then that we like to say, are we thinking about things properly? Are they properly valued? So geopolitical would be one thing that I would think about. The other one I think is just an interesting technical that's developed in the market, which is the private credit world has grown. And I'm sure you've spoken a lot on this show with people who are part of private credit or at least speaking about it. And it is a $1.7 trillion market right now. That's really big. We've never seen it this big. And the interesting dynamic is that money has been committed to it, but not all the capital has been called. So as you're a private credit investor, you're waiting for your capital to be called to go service deals. Where do you put it? And I think that's a big question. It's probably not sitting under a pillow or under a mattress somewhere. It's maybe in money markets. It's maybe in U.S. investment grade funds. Or maybe it's in public high yields, because that is a yield more analogous to what investors think they'll get in private credit.
That makes me wonder about liquidity, because if it all got called tomorrow, which it's not, but if it all got called tomorrow, that would take a lot of liquidity out of the marketplace. At the same time, you have the Fed starting to really run down the balance sheet, mm-hmm. which is taking liquidity out. Is there a prospect of really a liquidity issue here?
That is exactly the issue. I mean, you said it. If that capital needs to be called, likely there will be a liquidation of something to get that money out the door. And so that is something we're also thinking about. If investors have to sell, where are they going to sell? And with spreads, as I mentioned, so tight. I mean, some things like U.S. investment grade is at the 10th percentile. Really, really tight spreads. Could they stay at this level if there were four sellers or outflows? It'd be hard to imagine it could. And so big picture, when we're thinking about investing our portfolios, and I invest, me and the team, in public fixed income, we are constructive on risk, but we aren't all in. We're using, I would say, about 40 or 50% of our risk budget, meaning we have dry powder for if and when a geopolitical tension happens, flares up, maybe something like private credit and a movement of capital and a need to deploy money happens, or just a plain vanilla black swan occurs, mm-hmm. and they do, we want to be ready to be a liquidity provider.
Private credit, you mentioned a couple times private credit, which is huge, and mm-hmm. we do talk about a fair amount. Is there a risk there in private credit because of the name, private? That is to say, we don't necessarily know the valuations of the underlying assets. They don't mark to market the same way we do in a public market. Is that a risk for the system overall that could redound to all of our disbenefit?
Well, there is less transparency. You're absolutely right. There actually was a paper published by the Fed on February 23rd discussing all of this. But certainly having both the lack of transparency and the lack of liquidity. Private credit is locked up. It is not in the world I live in, a public fixed income. You can typically, and in most situations, get liquidity or your money, both invested or taken away on any given day. It is not that in private credit. So I think where there is a lack of transparency, there is more risk. Between the lack of transparency and also the lockup, you are given more of a spread or an additional yield compensation for that. So it should be priced into it. But there is something there. You're absolutely right.
Lindsay, it's a real treat to have you on Wall Street Week. That's Lindsay Rosner of Goldman Sachs. Finally, one more thought. Last weekend, Warren Buffett sent his annual letter to shareholders. And even as Berkshire Hathaway approached a market cap of $1 trillion, he doubled down on his quest for companies that, quote, can deliver wealth almost beyond measure. Even heirs to such a holding can, ugh, sometimes live a lifetime of leisure. That is an ugh from Warren Buffett. We've recently had plenty of examples of wealth beyond measure, even from those not pursuing Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger's conservative investment strategy. Much of this untold wealth has come from tech, as Elon Musk has amassed over $200 million, and Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and Bill Gates are all with him in the top five on the Bloomberg Billionaires list. Coming up fast is the co-founder of NVIDIA, Jensen Huang, who shot up the list to number 20 in just a few short months with a net worth of nearly $70 million thanks to his AI company capturing the imagination of investors everywhere.
Look, the godfather of AI in Jensen and NVIDIA. I mean, this is really the earnings heard around the world, the most important earnings in many years. And it shows this AI party, it's just getting started.
But it's not just tech. The man who owns everything from Veuve Clicquot to Givenchy to Louis Vuitton, Bernard Arnault, is the second richest person in the world, coming in just under Musk's $200 million.
Bernard Arnault is 74 years old. He's actually changed the rules recently to make sure he can run the company until he's 80. But clearly, the succession story at LVMH will be in everybody's mind over the next few years.
Even as the rich get richer, some of them a lot richer, economists like Paul Romer warn about the dangers of leaving so many of our fellow citizens behind.
If you look at employment, the average adult, the average number of adults who have a job in the United States has gone down, mostly because the people who are high school educated have such miserable prospects that some of them have given up. The rest are staying there in the market.
Other economists like Larry Summers say that economic growth and innovation doesn't require a tax system that prefers the accumulation of vast amounts of capital.
It defies belief that the young Bill Gates, the young Mark Zuckerberg, the young Steve Jobs would have not done their projects if they thought they would have had to pay a bit higher capital gains taxes, and we would have been without those companies.
And Warren Buffett himself has condemned a tax system where his secretary pays a higher tax rate than he does. But whatever the risks or benefits to unimaginable wealth, there's plenty of evidence that wealth doesn't have to translate into a life of leisure, Warren warned about. The wealthy routinely contribute enormous amounts to charity, led by Bill Gates, Elon Musk, and our very own Mike Bloomberg, each of whom, according to the Chronicle of Philanthropy, gave away more than $1 billion last year alone. And Warren himself is always at or near the top of that list. This week, we got another reminder of how much good can be done with great wealth when we learned of a gift of $1 billion to the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, which will pay for the tuition for all of its students in perpetuity. It came from a longtime member of the school's faculty and former board chair, Dr. Ruth Gottesman.
I'm happy to share with you that starting in August this year, the Albert Einstein College of Medicine will be tuition-free.
And where did it come from? Those companies Warren Buffett and his partner Charlie Munger have been picking through the years. It turns out that Dr. Ruth Gottesman is the widow of Sandy Gottesman, who connected with Buffett around the time Warren took over the company in 1965. He became one of Berkshire's biggest shareholders and served on its board. And when he passed away 2 years ago, he left $1 billion in stock to his widow with the instruction to, quote, do whatever you think is right with it. And now she's done just that. Warren Buffett also once said that someone's sitting in the shade today because someone planted a tree a long time ago. Thanks to the Gottesmans, the medical students at Albert Einstein will sit in the shade in perpetuity. That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.